You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 12th of January 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, just a short bit of news that caught my attention today as I was looking for suitable articles to use in the podcast. Afghan refugees in London have been treated to top football match tickets, free team shirts and regular football training sessions by big clubs. Premier League side Chelsea have joined the Championship's Fulham and QPR to be part of a campaign to help welcome Afghan refugees to West London. And I looked at that and I just thought, well, perhaps it's just me being cynical here, but what is Afghanistan linked to football for? What is the link that you think of when you think of Afghanistan and football? And of course, it was in the football stadiums that the Taliban used to execute paedophiles and people that had broken the Sharia law. So these Afghan refugees that are used to seeing people executed in football stadiums, they come to Britain, and the first thing that Britain can think of in order to welcome them is to give them free football match tickets. I don't know, maybe they're insulted by that. I'm sure they do think that's a bit of a bizarre thing to be doing. I mean, they're being treated as if they're celebrities, aren't they, really? I know a lot of people are upset at the way that our own people are being looked over in exchange for the Afghan refugees. Of course, you want to help people, but charity should begin at home. Have we got no Indigenous British people that need help? Have we got no homeless British people? No British people that need council houses or that would enjoy having free football tickets? There's a comment on Twitter to this, an anonymous comment, which also caught my eye. And it says, there is a gang of them in my gym. And that is Afghan refugees, which I pay a lot for on free passes. They stand around leering at the women and passing comments. Already there have been a couple of kickoffs. I am not renewing my membership. So they're not just being given free football tickets, they're being given free passes for the gym. I've no doubt they'll give them driving lessons and help with education, all the sorts of things that the Indigenous British people would actually like to have for free. Moving on from that, the theme of this week really has been this toppling of the Edward Colston statue, and this next article is related to that, and it's to do with these left-wing professors. And of course, evil always does end up eating itself, and the left end up eating themselves. This struggle to see who can be the most politically correct. Once they finish denouncing the people on the right, then they begin to denounce one another. In actual fact, it must be quite terrifying to actually be a left-wing celebrity now. If you look at the woman that wrote the Harry Potter series and the way that she's being treated now, simply for saying that there are two genders. She's been completely cancelled by the people that she actually made into stars. I'm not sure if she actually has to have police protection, but she's certainly had threats made to her. People have turned up at her home. And this is a very left-wing, woke author. So nobody is safe from this. And now what we have here is we have actual university professors that are well known for being social justice warriors that are now attacking one another over a really bizarre issue, I think. Two Cambridge University professors are locked in a woke war over whether calling a mixed-race Colston expert eloquent is offensive. Priyam Vada Gopal accused David Abu Lafia of being dismissive for using the word about history professor David Olosuga, whose father was Nigerian. And David Olosuga, he is eloquent. That is a word that you could use to describe him. He uses a lot of long words, basically, to explain things that are could probably be explained with more simple language. He is very biased in his view on history. Not just biased in the way that you would imagine black people would be interested in black history, but very biased against whites. And that is what black history is, unfortunately. It's just a litany of all the terrible things that white people allegedly did to black people. It's most unfortunate, actually, that that is the way that it has turned out. But this David Olosuga, you often see him on the BBC. They often wheel him out as their expert, and he is eloquent. I would say that he is eloquent. I don't see how that can be accused of, how the word can be linked with racism, though. And this Priyam Vada Gopal, she's a hideous anti-white. The way that she speaks about white people is probably worse than this David Olosuga. She claimed using the words eloquent or articulate for intellectuals of colour could be seen as a sleight of hand dismissal. She said it implied the person was just whipping up passions and had no substance. Well, I don't see how that is. I mean, it's really a compliment to say that somebody is eloquent or to say that they are articulate. I mean, what is she saying here? Is she saying that most non-intellectuals of colour are not eloquent or articulate, and that by saying that he is eloquent, it is implying that non-intellectuals of colour are ineloquent? And it really doesn't make a lot of sense here. In response, Professor Abu Lafia labelled her utterly bizarre, accusing her of twisting everyday language. He denies that his words were offensive and said that both white and black people could be equally described as eloquent without racial implications. The interesting thing here is that they're all attacking one another, basically. The row erupted after Professor Abu Lafia, a history don, wrote an article for the Daily Telegraph about the trial of activists who toppled the statue of Edward Colston in Bristol. He argued that pulling down the statue did not aid historical understanding and that the activists should not be deciding its fate. So I think what we really have here is the fact that he was not cheering on Black Lives Matter in this vandalism that went on, and she's taken a dislike to that. And I think that's what this is all about, and the only way she has of fighting back against somebody is to denounce them as a racist. And this is really what we see. We don't see any well thought out arguments. We just see a denunciation as racist or bigot or white supremacist, and that's supposedly the end of the argument. Well, what that really means is that the person calling out the names, the person using the ad hominems, is the one who has lost the argument. It is the most ungraceful way of accepting that you have lost an argument to start calling the other person names. I mean, it really means that you don't actually have an answer for what they are saying. Debate should never descend into name calling, and yet that is all we see from our opponents. They just call us names all the time. If you look at the mainstream media when it covers Patriotic Alternative, you know that the article is going to include the words white supremacist, neo-Nazi, racist, bigot. They never actually look at what Patriotic Alternative are saying and then try to counter it. A good example of that would be the warning about the census results, which show that white people are going to be a minority in Britain by 2060. These are the government's own figures. And they point this out, and then they say, how horrific. Look at what these white supremacists are saying, putting out this conspiracy theory. They don't actually try to challenge that comment. They just cast aspersions about the person making the comment. And of course, all Patriotic Alternative are doing is drawing the public's attention to something that is known in academia that the mainstream media does not want people to know. Getting back to this Professor Aboulafia, he added as an aside, the jury was not being asked to judge Colston, even though the defence thought it appropriate to call the eloquent David Olosuga as a witness and to ask him to describe Colston's career. So what they're really trying to do there is to say that what these Black Lives Matter supporters were doing was acting in self-defence. They're trying to say that because Colston was now a designated racist by today's standards, it was perfectly acceptable to attack his statue, like a form of self-defence, because the statue's presence was deemed to be so awful for the Bristolians. Really, the crux of this matter should have really been whether it was criminal damage that they were involved in, which it quite clearly was. The judge should have said, well, there's no need to call a witness that can be an expert on Edward Colston's career. What should be being decided here is whether the statue was damaged or not, and whether it was public property. This whole case was just decided on feelings rather than on the facts of the matter. And of course, that's what these speech crime cases are based upon. They're based upon feelings rather than the facts of the matter. And this is the first time that it's actually been physical damage, criminal damage, that has been decided on feelings. As far as I'm aware, I may be wrong there. There may be other instances where there's been criminal damage and they've managed to get away with it by saying, oh, yes, well, it was a representation of a racist, so it doesn't matter if we break the law. Professor Gopal, who teaches post-colonial literature, seized on the article and posted it on Twitter. This was seemingly in response to a tweet from another academic who claimed that the writings of academics that champion bigotry would not pass an intro class. Yes, but they claim that everybody up until, well, these last couple of decades, all the white people up until the last couple of decades were apparently secret racists and bigots. And yet, what about all the academics from years gone by? What about all the academics from the time of Edward Colston? They were all profiting from slavery, just the same as the Africans in Africa, the black Africans. They were also profiting from slavery. So to say here the writings of academics that champion bigotry would not pass an intro class is just not true. And what would actually happen, though, is if there was an expert witness in a court that championed bigotry, he would not be allowed to actually give his witness statement. But David Olosuga, as an expert witness, he's allowed to go in there and completely trash Edward Colston and make him out to be a white supremacist and a racist, when quite clearly he was a good man. He was a philanthropist. He did everything he could for his people, which is essentially exactly the same as what David Olosuga is doing. He's doing his very best for his people, and he's succeeding at doing that. As a black history professor, he's a very good advocate for black people. I'm not going to criticize him for that. So why does he criticize Edward Colston for doing his best for his people, doing his best for the British people, and trying to and not just making as much money as he could and spending it all on himself, but making as much money as he could through trade and then passing that on into the city and building up Bristol as a city? He didn't want to talk about that, of course. He just wanted to talk about what a racist Edward Colston was and how he was involved in the slave trade. David Olosuga's ancestors were also involved in the slave trade. Black people are not innocent in the slave trade by any standards. They were the ones that were actually selling the slaves in the first place. They were right at the start of the production line, basically, producing the slaves and then selling them on. White people and Jews were just facilitating that and sending them on up the chain until they ended up working on the farms. And when they were working on the farms, They had their keep paid for. They had their clothing paid for. They had a roof over their head. They had food. They essentially had everything that an apprentice had 150 years ago. When we were doing the Real Britannia episode this week, I discovered that in 1850, if you were an apprentice grocer, which would take 2 or 3 years, you would have your food paid for and you would have a roof over your head, but that would be it. Everything else you would be expected to pay for yourself. So it wasn't really that different to slavery. I mean, these slaves were expected to pick fruit, and in return for picking fruit or for picking cotton, they had everything paid for. Even medical costs, and also a pension when they were too old to work, and also a creche if they ended up getting pregnant. So you cannot say that black people did not profit from slavery, because the black African chiefs that sold the slaves in the first place, they exchanged them for goods, or they exchanged them for gold or silver or guns or whatever it was that they wanted, in the same way that the white people that bought the slaves traded them on again for guns or goods or gold or silver or whatever it was that they actually wanted. Everybody profited from the slave trade. And in actual fact, it was cheaper to pay people wages than it was to actually keep a slave. And that's the real reason why it was done away with, or at least that was the accusation that was being made at the time, that it was because it was cheaper to just pay wages. Because if you had a slave, you had to pay £10,000 or the equivalent of that for the slave in the first place. And then you had to pay for them for the rest of their lives, essentially. Much cheaper just to pay someone the wages for the work that they do. And then it doesn't matter if they get ill, you can just employ somebody else, which that couldn't happen if you own a slave. You had to keep looking after them. Professor Abulafia hit back at Professor Gopal in an interview with student newspaper Varsity, calling her comments insulting or potentially libelous. And I guess that's because she's inferring that he was racist in actually using this word eloquent. The former chairman of the history faculty said, "I have never heard the use of the word eloquent being linked to racism. David Olusoga has a marvellous ability to communicate. I admire that enormously. The word eloquent is the perfect word to use." And yeah, I would agree with that. As I said, David Olusoga does have a good grasp of the English language. Professor Abulafia, 72, was born in London to a Jewish family and spent most of his career at Cambridge, specialising in Mediterranean history. So what we have here is we have an Indian, a Jew, and an African heritage professor, all arguing together about who can denounce the other for being a racist, basically. Professor Gopal, 54, has spoken about having family roots in India and is vocal on Twitter about race. In October, she was stopped from delivering a lecture in Whitehall because of remarks she made about Home Secretary Priti Patel. You see, all of these people, they show their loyalty to their ethnicity, and that is praised, and we encourage that. And obviously, as a nationalist, I encourage that. But then when we as white people try to be positive about our race and try to be positive about our ancestors and to advocate for the sort of things that we think are going to improve our lives, we're accused of being racists and white supremacists. And yet you don't hear people calling David Olusoga a black supremacist for making everything that he does about his ethnicity. And he surely does do that. He's a professor of black history. Why don't we have a professor of white history, I wonder? And the Daily Mail has tried to contact all of these professors, and it doesn't say here whether they got a comment or not. And knowing the way these journalists operate, even if they did get a comment, they don't actually have to print it. And we do have another tweet here that I thought was pretty good on this, which is from Save Our Statues. They say, "In 879 AD, the corpse of Pope Formosius was dug up and put on trial. It was found guilty. In 2022 AD, a British court put Edward Colston, who died in 1721, on trial. He too was found guilty. nice to see us reviving some old traditions. So that's really what was going on in this case. It wasn't a trial of four people for criminal damage. It was putting this historical character on trial and, of course, finding him wanting, as they would do on anybody in the 17th or 18th century if he was being judged by modern morality. And, of course, somebody back then who was going to be judging somebody from the modern world, they would find us to be immoral. They would say the fact that we promote homosexuality was completely immoral. The way that we allow abortions, that's immoral. Gay marriage, that's immoral. They would say that all of that was equally as bad as the way that people today are thinking about Edward Colston. And it really shows you that the zeitgeist changes through the times, and the way that we think about things changes through history. That's why it's important that we have religion, which is supposed to be unchanging, and we have religious laws that are supposed to be eternal. And that's why they are necessary, because we will find ways to argue to ourselves that they should be changed otherwise. I have another news story here that I would like to get into, which really provides an alternative view to the one that was being espoused by the socialist worker yesterday. And of course, the socialist worker yesterday was supporting Black Lives Matter and was saying that even though the Colston Four were found not guilty, the state was still against the Black Lives Matter protesters because rioters had been put in prison for setting fire to a police van. And what we have here is a news story from America about a white police officer and the way that he was treated by the state. Christine Dages, the wife of former police officer Matthew Dages, says the left-wing state has put her family through the fires of hell after her husband was wrongfully vilified and accused of a felony in regards to a 2020 arrest of a suspect in La Mesa, California. Christine Dages detailed her husband's case that sent social justice and Black Lives Matter activists protesting outside their home in La Mesa in 2020, around the same time as George Floyd's death in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And she goes on to explain what happened. On May the 27th, 2020, Matthew, my husband, was working as a police officer for the city of La Mesa. He was working in a detail with other officers, and he was involved in a very low-level use of force against a combative subject who had already assaulted Matthew. And this is the case in most of these instances that Black Lives Matter get a hold of. The victim will have been resisting arrest. They will have been attacking the police officer. And you think, well, these police officers are armed. If the suspect can overpower the police officer, he can grab hold of the police officer's gun, and then he could start shooting people. So they have to use considerable force to neutralize any suspect that is resisting arrest in America. And really, Black Lives Matter, if they wanted there to be less black people that end up being seriously hurt or killed by the police, they should be giving black people lessons in schools on what to do if they get arrested, and to say to them, just do what the officer tells you to do. Don't resist arrest. Whatever you do, don't resist arrest. Instead of that, the mainstream media and Black Lives Matter put out this narrative that when a black person is arrested, it's very likely that they're going to get shot and killed. A lot of these black people have the idea that the police are just looking for black people so that they can then kill them. So then when a black person does get arrested by the police, they're extremely fearful, they're terrified for their lives, and of course they're going to start resisting arrest and they're going to start fighting back against the police officer because they fear for their lives. And then because they're fighting back and resisting arrest, they end up getting shot. I mean, and it's not the sort of lower class, working class blacks that feel like this. It's even the sort of blacks that actually become politicians. They will say that they were fearful because they got arrested and they thought they might get attacked by the black police officer. We had Dawn Butler last year that was filming a police officer because he asked the car that she was in to stop because the car had been driving the wrong way on a one-way system. And she filmed all of that. And she said, oh, she had to film it just in case the police might have harmed the people that were in the car and that she was fearful. And the reason for that is because of this public narrative. So this police officer was trying to arrest somebody, and the person he was trying to arrest had fought back and he had assaulted the police officer. So he used a very low level of force against this subject, and they describe him as a combative subject, so he was definitely fighting back. And she continues, she says, his department deemed his use of force justified, but the subject posted a video of their interaction online with the hashtag George Floyd, and it went viral. There were riots for days and the city burned down. Social justice activists called Matthew a racist and they demanded that he be fired and criminally charged just for doing his job. So the so-called victim in this wasn't killed because they were able to actually post this video of the interaction online. But because it was timed with George Floyd and because he called him a racist, that was it. Huge riots, masses of amounts of damage. I should imagine millions of dollars worth of damage was done here. And Christine Dages continues. She says, when the city burned down, we actually had protests at our home as well. So they must have felt really threatened by that. I mean, that is terrorism, isn't it? The implication of violence to achieve a political aim is violence. And they must have feared for their lives if they actually had these protesters at their home, the same protesters that have been burning down the city. She says, our personal information was doxxed online, so we had to move. So we no longer live here. However, it's really interesting. I feel like our story and what the city of La Mesa is doing to us is a cautionary tale for police families on what can happen in left-led cities when political pressure is applied. And remember that the police know that he was in the innocent here. He had been attacked by this person he was trying to arrest, and all he had done is use a low level of force. But the person he was trying to arrest was black and the police officer was white. At the time, Christine Dages said La Mesa politicians bowed to the mob and they used her husband as a scapegoat to end the destructive riots, firing him from the police department and criminally charging him with one felony count of filing a false police report to arrest the suspect. So they basically gave in to the mob. And this is what we see happening more and more recently. What happened with George Floyd was just bowing to the mob, basically. George Floyd quite clearly died of a drug overdose. That's what the autopsy said. And yet the officer involved was charged with murder. You only have to look at the video of George Floyd in the shop dancing around with a banana before handing over the counterfeit note to see that he was high on drugs. And then all you have to do is watch the video where he's trying to climb out of the police car. It's quite clear he is resisting arrest, and the police officer was doing actually what George Floyd said he wanted. He wanted to climb out of the car and lie on the ground, and he was just preventing him from getting away. Yet, because the mob demanded it, and because the mob were claiming that race was the reason, racial injustice was the reason for the riots, the court just basically bowed to the mob. And we see the same thing with James Fields, who accidentally drove his car forwards when a mob of left-wing protesters attacked the car, smashed out the back tail light. He panicked, drove forwards. One protester had a heart attack and died, and he was charged with terrorism and deliberately trying to run all those people over. I believe that that was just a simple car accident. But because of the pressure, from the mainstream media, he was found guilty of terrorism and given 400 years. So the people that are really in charge of the courts today are the mainstream media. And they're the ones that are really in charge of the politicians as well. They can manipulate the politicians with what they actually cover. And the police here, who used to be above this, or we used to think that the police were above this, They bowed to the mob and they used Christine Dage's husband as a scapegoat. In December 2021, after only about a day's worth of deliberating, a California jury found Matthew Dages not guilty of the felony charge, and now Christine Dages is fighting to get her husband's job back. She says, "The best way I can describe it is walking through the fires of hell. It's been constant agony, not just for us as newlyweds, we got married just before this incident, but for our entire family. It feels like walking through fire because my husband is a white police officer who did his job. So we are people of faith, which has helped to keep our heads above water. It's been agonizing on every level, and I would not wish that hell on anyone. Yes, he was acquitted last month, and victory is so wonderful, but our battle is far from over. We are almost 2 years into this, and we are still fighting. It has been emotionally, mentally agonizing on every level." And of course, his face will have been plastered all across the newspapers there and the mainstream media. He will have been classified as a designated racist, and he would have been frightened to actually show his face, I should imagine. Other law enforcement agencies in California and around the nation have reached out to offer Matthew Dages a job, expressing their support for his defense, his wife said. But first, though, Matthew needs to get his police officer status back. She says, "We kind of had to learn the hard way that California is one of the worst places to be a police officer, and it is very dangerous in terms of its political structure for police families. We really are seeing this play out nationally, with the left demonizing police tactics and really prioritizing criminals over cops," she continued. "So that was really eye-opening for me as a police wife." And really, I think part of this could be these political appointees that they make. Over here in Britain, Tony Blair instituted that. You get the chance to vote for the police commissioner of your area, the same as you get to vote for a mayor in Manchester or London, and you get to vote for who you want to be in charge of the police. And of course, then it's a political appointment. And whoever is going to get voted in, they're going to get voted in because they are politically correct, rather than they're a very good police officer. I think we see the same thing with Cressida Dick in the Metropolitan Police. She was put into that role not because she was a fantastic police officer, but because she ticked all the diversity boxes, and she had done what she was supposed to do as far as the establishment told her with the killing of John Charles de Menezes, the Brazilian guy that was, the innocent Brazilian guy that was shot by the police, assassinated by the police on the underground. She had something to do with that. So she helped the establishment out there, I believe. And she is a very, very politically correct person. And that is why she's been given her position. And of course, that's why there are all these criticisms of her. And I think you get the same thing in America. A lot of the people that are in charge of the police, that their loyalties are not to the police. They're political appointees, and they get to the top role not because of how good they are at their job, but because they adhere to politically correct ideology. And that's what happened here. It was a black mob claiming that this police officer was a racist, and therefore the police got rid of the police officer, even though he was completely innocent. We should not be giving in to the mob. I mean, this sets a really, really worrying precedent for the years to come, where we will be are essentially just ruled by the mob and the threat of violence from different ethnicities. That's what you get with a multicultural country. You end up being held to ransom by the whichever ethnicity is the most violent and causes the most damage. And in a way, you can see why it's tempting to go along with that, because you don't want your city to be burned down. But if you give in to the mob, then you're essentially saying that you're giving up civilization. And we are on the cusp of losing our civilization, I believe, which is why we draw attention to these subjects here at Radio Albion. Well, thank you very much for listening. I'll be back tomorrow with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.